Means Committee, and we're going to continue this afternoon our public hearing on the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And could we have Linda Gilbert, excuse me, come forward, please, and present a summary of the governor's proposed budget?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I will be speaking from a document that looks like this. And I will be giving an overview of the governor's recommended budget for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. On the first page, page 2, actually, there's a summary that shows the total budget is $7.7 million. Of that, $3.3 million is general fund. It represents a 3.6% increase over the legislatively approved budget for 9901. And in fact, represents no change, or is no change from current service levels. On the following page, page 3, there's a consolidated view of the budget by fund type. General fund is about 43%. Other funds at 2.6 million, about 34%. And federal funds are about 22% at 1.6%. $7 million is also a $100,000 non-limited limitation, if I can say that without being ironic, for mine land reclamation. Other funds not limited. On the following page, page 4, the governor's recommended budget, as you said, was a 3.6% increase over legislatively approved budget. It continues all the agency base programs at a current service level. And it phases out one-time funding and a position associated with 1999 Senate Bill 12 for landslide work. On the following page, page 5, it's another view of the budget by program unit, and there are three program units. I believe that you heard about this yesterday in testimony and will continue to hear more about other program units. There are technical support and administration at 34% of the budget, geologic investigations at about 45% of the budget, and then mine land reclamation at 21% of the budget. The following page is another view of the agency budget, this time by expenditure categories, and there are only two for this particular agency, personal services and services and supplies. The next page is a walkthrough from the legislatively approved budget through governor's recommended. The agency appeared before the emergency board for three separate items in February of this year, totaling about $200,000. One was operational expenses for the coastal field office. That was a $25,000 general fund item. There was a $65,000 funding for professional services and publications that had been held back by the 99 legislature. It came back and got in February. And finally, there were standard salary adjustments at the February e-board.
Are these included in the roll-up costs for the agencies this time?
The salary adjustments are, yes. There were adjustments to the current, to arrive at current service level budget. It included the base budget adjustments. We're phasing out the position for Senate Bill 12. There were vacancy savings and non-personal services related, or non-PICS, which is the personal services computer system that we use. There are some other adjustments that need to be made that particular system doesn't automatically roll in. In addition, there's inflation generally at 2.5% with some exceptions. One was attorney general costs, another is rent, and the third is professional services. Some professional services are inflated at 3.5%. Inflation for this agency totaled about $117,000. And this is how we arrive at current service level, which was a total of $7.7 million. There are no policy packages, and on the final page, no fee or revenue changes, no new programs, and no technical adjustments. That completes my overview of the agency budget.
Representative Hayden, do you have a question?
That's a little.
Question? No?
Was that a question?
No, I didn't. Oh. I didn't ask that question.
Okay.
I thought you were soliciting a question. No, no, that was just.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Should we continue with our presentation then of the agency's programs and services? And we have John Bolio, the state geologist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Bolio, the state geologist. Again, with me today are some distinguished staff members and guests. We met the staff members yesterday. We're with us today. New people we have in the back, Don Christensen, who is chairman of our board, and also with us is Grace Lynch, mother of Gary Lynch, who is supervisor of Mine and Reclamation. She hails from Massachusetts, and we're hoping that she can control him this afternoon. And she makes no promises. She attended a basketball game where her grandson's team lost last night, and she's hoping to see better things today here this afternoon.
So are you suggesting we be nice to our son today?
Absolutely. I don't intend to be nice, so somebody else. I thought what we might do today, if it's okay with you, Madam Chair, is that there were a few unanswered questions yesterday, which I'd like to touch on briefly. And I would like to spend some time talking to agency activities as it relate to watershed issues and water issues for people and for salmon and endangered species. And Gary Lynch could talk about mine land reclamation issues, which are quite complex. And I think that will take care of most of the things we want to talk about. And then if we got past that or into tomorrow, there are some wrap-up comments of a very brief nature that Dennis Olmsted should probably make regarding some of the new charts you see. And then we could do closing comments or however that's handled this time. So I'll start with the answers to the questions. And this the handout this time. And one of the questions was for Representative Krupp, who isn't here. Basically, the residual question is the server for technical data used in-house accessible from outside the agency? And his question specifically was on a 24-hour basis. The answer to the question is yes, provided the person has all the passwords. And the reason for that is that our staff works off-site quite often on the weekends and the evenings. That's how they get into the file. It's okay. There's nothing here that's of a confidential nature. And what a hacker can't get in that server, they can buy from us over the counter or get off the website someday, hopefully anyway. So we do have some protections built in, but it's not a total firewall. Okay. Secondly, Madam Chair, you asked a fairly complicated question yesterday.
Thank you.
That I would like to touch on to get to the core of the issue I think you were addressing. You were asking specifically how much professional time in Program 1 and 3 specifically is allocated to specific services for those people representing the mining industry. And you were looking for a number. And the answer to the question is approximately 2 to 5%, you know, of activity above and beyond routine public service, like showing them where the library is and how to buy a publication. And the 2 to 5% is conducted by a person who is on non-general fund already. I would like to mention at least one example of a fairly rigorous type of activity that I think is interesting in this context. We've had a mining company that goes unnamed, and they go unnamed partly because it's confidential what their name is and partly because I don't remember what it is anyway. But they have been interested in putting a plate glass manufacturing plant in Southwest Oregon and have been conducting negotiations with landowners, resource holders, transportation people, government people now for almost 2 years. Basically, on the west coast of North America, there's a shortage of plate glass, and there's an opportunity to put something on I-5. Southwest Oregon is a place of choice. How do we fit into this? They're looking for local sources of silica sand, which is what Dennis mentioned yesterday. Now, the way our activities play into this, in years gone by, when we had staff that could do field work for mineral activity, and when we had a lab, we did a study on silica sand that was published in 1990, and it pointed out about 8 or 9 locations in Oregon that might have potential sand for such use. So when the phone call came our way, actually it came Department of Economic Development's way, and then they contacted us and said, what do you know about these things? We saw that they got the publication, and we provided a briefing. Things moved ahead. Where it stands now is the resource has been identified in Oregon. It was one of the 8 we looked at. The resource is there in adequate quantity. But there are other problems in terms of the legal status of the land and how various people on the private sector choose to conduct themselves or negotiate what they want out of the deal. So the deal is on hold at the moment. It's possible that silica sand will be shipped in as far away from Idaho, and the plant may still be built in Oregon. The reason I bring this up is that over the period of 2 years, we probably had an individual go to 5 or 6 meetings, provide a publication, talk to people on the telephone, and this person has done all of this without any particular compensation from this company. But I would go on to say that economic development does not charge for their input, the county commissioners don't charge, the city planners don't charge, and LCDC doesn't charge. And if we were to say to people like this, we're charging for our services, the clock is starting to tick now, we would basically drive away these opportunities. So I go back to management of the agency and I say, have we got it about right? Well, we're spending about 2 to 5% of our professional time in program one in these kinds of conversations. And one of the yellow boxes on the chart here, fifth row in, second one down, is funded by outside funding anyway. So we're not using general fund to promote the needs of a private sector specific client. This subject is fairly important to me as I've watched the agency evolve in the last 10 years especially, since there's a difference that we try to manage for and we recognize between serving as a consultant and serving as a geologic survey that provides public service. And the question is, where do you draw this line? A consulting firm provides a service for a predetermined or pre-identified client up front for a fee. We don't do that. We provide more general information that is of value as a public service to a broad public, none of whom can be identified up front, and none of whom individually can afford or can even design the kind of information gathering that we do. Below me in front is a map of Salem. The city of Salem, in looking at landslide issues, could very easily have said, we're afraid of landslides, we're hereby mandating that everybody do a site-specific study of a rigorous nature. And that would solve the problem. But instead, they worked with us in partnership. We developed a map that says only certain of the darker colors are in terrain that really requires that kind of thing. And as was described yesterday by Dennis, and also described to us by the city planner on Monday at a field trip for our board meeting, this particular database now allows the people in the yellow zones, for example, to move ahead with much cheaper requirements, and we still have reasonable and prudent confidence that the hazard has been addressed. That is a general public service. It is a public service that saves the city money, it saves the private sector money, and it benefits the public. Now, the parts of the agency that at one time benefited the mining agencies, mining companies, which was the original purpose of the department years ago, were all sheared off in the Measure 5 adjustments in the late 1990s, as I pointed out. We lost our lab, we lost some of our staff, we lost a minerals economist. So the things that we now see as possible grounds for finding money by charging specific people, to me, it is a de minimis activity to search for that, but if that's where we're going, we can help you do that, and we might find some scraps somewhere. In terms of looking for large bags of money, we don't do those things anymore, or at least I don't think we do. Perhaps there are examples you're aware of that I would have to think through again, but anyway, that's basically where I'm at. A second example that I would like to bring up, and I wish Senator Farioli were here, is one in Eastern Oregon. Eastern Oregon has a challenged economy. There isn't a lot going on over there. Well, there are some things. There's tourism and there's farming, things like that. But in terms of my department, it's a challenged economy. For the last 10 years, there has been a grassroots effort brewing to take better advantage of some incredibly unique geologic resources in Eastern Oregon of a fairly broad nature. We're talking about fossil deposits and fossil beds. Some of the fossil beds of Eastern Oregon are the best records of environmental change and environment and ecosystem data from the fossil record anywhere in the world. And people are taking interest in these. We've all heard of the John Day fossil beds. But taking good and strategic advantage of all of this has been brewing in the backs of many people's minds. We have county judges, we have private sector people, we have federal agencies, we have even some congressmen interested in this. And what's on tap here is an effort for which we have expended no money. But there is what's on tap here is an effort to link the various fossil beds together and to develop a network of research opportunities, tourist opportunities, and educational opportunities that could bring a lot of activity, relatively speaking, into various parts of Eastern Oregon. They would network with the High Desert Museum, network with a variety of embryonic efforts already. This has congressional attention. When people call my office, I don't have people to put on that project. Because in Baker City, I have one person out full-time making maps on contract, which they are mandated to do to maintain their employment. And I have the other person mapping with them because they are matched to get the first one. As I suggested yesterday, when people come in the door and need a public service, we can't always give it to them. So what I did was write a letter to one of the advocates, and that's the second handout. And I said, we don't have a lot of money, but we've got good ideas. These people are meeting in our office Friday afternoon to decide what to do next. And again, I have to say it's puzzling after all these years to me. It's puzzling to be the agency that is lead on the geology, to say I can't help you with money or anything else, and to hear that another agency in this state has provided them $50,000 of startup money to do whatever it is they want to do. So it feels just a little bit funny to be not being able to participate when there's money being sent to these people from other agencies, in this case economic development.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bowman.
Thank you. And so what are you suggesting? You're suggesting that there should be a process whereby before they sent the money, they should have talked to you?
I guess what I'm, Madam Chair, Representative Bowman, what I'm suggesting is I think the agency's been backed into a corner over a period of about 30 years regarding revenue structure, that it's making it increasingly difficult for us to provide what would be very beneficial public service. I'm not asking for more money, and I'm not suggesting that economic development did anything wrong. I'm glad they're participating. In my letter, I suggested they be approached. I'm wishing we could do more.
A follow-up question, Madam Chair. Is there something more you could do working with the Economic Development Department so that they know you're there and what services you provide, so that you are taking more of a leadership role in figuring out how you work with other state agencies?
Madam Chair, Representative Bowman, I don't feel comfortable assigning any staff large amounts to this. What I anticipate happening on Friday will be a productive discussion where we will find some more things we can do for them, and I hope economic development is there.
Thank you.
There may be things to, now they also have, they've also purchased all of the publications we've ever put out in that area on over the years. Over the last 30 or 40 years, we've prompted a lot of independent research over there, and we published a lot of it. They have that. We bought those. So I think this is a great opportunity. I take personal interest in it because it was 50 years ago that I started being interested in geology, and it was fossils that got me there. So this is something I'll do long after I retire. I'll be involved with these people. So,
Madam Chair, if I may, it just didn't feel right what you just said. So I'm just trying to understand what if in the ideal world, what would be taking place that isn't taking place right now?
Madam Chair, in the ideal world, what would be taking place right now, and I'm not asking for it, is that we would have a part of a position that I could have the discretion to place on that effort to make it work. I would perhaps have somebody other than myself attending these board meetings for that activity.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. And I guess another place where I'm leading is I'm here to defend the governor's budget, and I will refer back to this type of example when I ask that cuts be minimal or very small or very carefully managed. That's where the committee chooses to go. Okay. I think I've answered the question about staff time on certain activities. And I think I've answered the question about the server.
Yes, I read that. Thank you, Madam Chair, if I may. Thank you very much. I appreciate you doing that.
And I learned a few things pursuing the answer to that question.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Okay, what I would like to do now would be to spend a little time talking about our watershed-type activities, and then we'll move into Gary's presentation, unless there are other questions at this time.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I see that all the squiggly red lines on that document are gone today. I was just wondering, you know, as a child, did you, you know, crayons on the wall kind of thing? Is that? Just a moment of levity there. Please continue.
We have many, many copies of that chart. We just put a print on our plotter and that's a new one. And then we recycle the paper.
That's good.
My high school teacher wanted me to major in art. I figured if I was going to be a failure at something, I had to be geology.
So, Madam Chair and Johnny, if I may, I see that the other document down in front of your desk has to do with fault lines. And that's, again, is partly what you identify as your mission is to map faults. And at some point in time, I'd like to have either you or some of your staff talk about the geologic stability of our faults here in Oregon, whenever that's appropriate. Not particularly now, but whenever it's appropriate.
What I'm going to do then, Madam Chair, in response to that, I'm going to send some of my comments here and move that to make sure we can fit that in.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. One of the things I did when I took over the chair in the director's office was I wanted to move the agency more towards water-related issues. And we had been working with water resources in the field in the Bend area, and we had worked in Klamath Falls area and a few other places. But what I wanted to do was to crystallize where we might make the best unique contribution. So, second or the third handout, Eric, what we did was we tackled a variety of watersheds in a variety of ways during the last biennium. Most of the efforts you see here summarized, we don't want to go through all of these examples, except to say that we deliberately looked at a variety of different kinds of watersheds in the state, urban, rural, eastern Oregon, western Oregon, southern Oregon, different conditions, as the requests were made of us. And we did what we could. And for some of them, we did a lot, and some we did next to nothing. But we learned what our contribution could be. And we can move ahead a little bit on that. And so I'd like to work our way through some of these examples, with your permission. This is a geology map of part of the LeGrand area, just north of LeGrand. And basically, it's a blueprint of the rocks. The different colors tell us different kinds of rocks. And they're configured three-dimensionally so that we have to draw a diagram here as if we were to slice the earth in half and have a look at it. Basic geology map coming out of a cooperative program driven by an advisory committee that meets once a year. involving data users, not necessarily data researchers. So here comes this map, and what we tried to do was take our grant, our proposal to the federal government for their half of the funding, so to speak, and torque that around so we could land on a quadrangle that was near communities and therefore relevant to people. We have to torque that around. The grant is down here. Here's the map. Here's the cross-section. Now, the thing that is significant from the standpoint of water is that we observed up on the hills, right up in here, there are certain rock units that by their nature, we say these conduct water. We know they conduct water. In the valley, they're down low. The rocks that conduct water in the valley are beneath the surface.
Madam Chair. John, define conduct. Absorb,
water,
transport?
Transmit.
Okay, transmit.
Transmit.
Okay. To where?
Wherever you want to drill a hole.
Okay, so it transmits down through the rock, is what you're saying.
Through
okay.
The rock. Lateral,
okay. All right.
Okay. So, the Watershed Council for the Grand Ronde approaches us about 3 years ago and says, will you help us understand our water problem in the La Grande Basin, because this isn't making any sense to us. We've got fish issues, and we have people issues, and we need some water. So here is the next quadrangle down, where they funded part of our work to look at this area. So now we have some federal money, some of our matching effort, some watershed effort, and we start collecting data in the valley area, and we notice that the mud, the alluvium in this valley, is over 2,000 feet thick. Normally, in alluvial units, one gets water. In this area, when one punches wells, one doesn't get water, or not much. This mud is so fine-grained that water, it's saturated with water, but water will not flow into a well. This is and there are geologic reasons for that. I can go into that. I'll just say there are geologic reasons why that's so. We know what they are. We understand that going in. But we also know that the rock unit that has water is down here. So we complicated the partnership even more. We said, we think we can help solve problems here. There was a water well going down here where the driller kept drilling deeper and deeper and deeper, and he had poured $200,000 or $300,000 into one well and was still going down.
Oh my.
Looking for water. Is he ever going to find it? He asks us. We said, you're going to find it at about 2,500 feet. $500,000 go into the well. Now it flows at 80 gallons a minute. Found the water we told him would be there. We worked a partnership with this person. He's drilling another well. We want the data here. He wants the water. We said, we'll drop in on you once in a while, but every 10 feet, will you collect a sample, put it in a bag, and label it so that then we have free data from top to bottom and can make a better diagram the next time this question comes up. That is how we partnered to solve a water problem or help solve it in this area. Presently, the Bureau of Reclamation has our report and is using it to strategize basin-wide strategies for drilling wells versus drawing water out of streams to enhance the proper management of the water in this. And what we've done is provided a proper understanding of the plumbing. We don't count the water, we don't manage the water, we don't regulate the water. But we tell people where the pipes are, and that helps them get the job done. So that's just one example. Now they're saying, will you stay here and help us? And we're saying, no. The people on this chart have to go somewhere else now to get their money, because you don't have a watershed contract or an OWEB contract or whatever it takes to keep us here. We're out scrambling for money to save our jobs. They're scrambling in the Klamath Basin. In the Klamath Basin, the same story, but here we took oil and gas technology, geophysical stuff, the things that geophysicists use to find oil and gas, and we use those technologies to characterize the rocks in advance of drilling and to say,
where do we think the water might be? In this case, the bullseye is yellow. The water well was drilled for $100,000 with Bureau of Reclamation money. They found the water. The way we got the money was great. Water resources, we said, we do not have enough people in our department to put on the table this match for a federal grant because they're parceled out somewhere else. The Water Resources Department said, we'll do that for you. We have a person in the area. He's part of the effort anyway. On paper, we will put him on paper. You can use him as match. That will get us the money. So now we have a partnership that has U.S. Geological Survey, Local Watershed Council, Bureau of Reclamation, Water Resources Department, Department of Agriculture, because they have geohydrologists that tell how to use water, all of them working in this area, using geophysical technology from the oil companies, decide where to put the well to get the water. This water might be used to better manage the total budget of water, surface versus groundwater, to perhaps help solve the fish problem in the Klamath Basin. We continue to map in this area. The various quadrangles we've mapped or are going to map, they're indicated, and those are target quadrangles for which we need detailed information. We can't map them all. That's another example of how we're helping with the watershed councils. Finally, we had an example. A phone call came in to our minerals person. It was yellow, and he oversees the databases. He doesn't do studies in the field anymore, but he oversees the databases. This is for south coast or south somewhere in the middle of the Willamette Valley. Here's Cottage Grove, Eugene's up here. And we said, we can't do anything for you of a rigorous nature. This guy's on soft money, non-general fund, and you don't have any to give us. But we're doing this experiment here to learn. So we're going to commit to this anyway. We're going to stretch a little bit. And on this one, instead of the basins being 2,000 feet thick, basins are very thin. The bedrock, instead of transmitting water, doesn't transmit water. Rule of thumb in this part of the state, if you're looking for groundwater, it's going to be hard to find much of it in any given well. Well, they were concerned about water quality issues. We're worried about mercury in the water. We're worried about landslides. We're worrying about what that does to fish. So we simply gave them our databases. Here's where the metal mines are. Here's where the debris flows were in 1996. Here's where deeper slides are that might be, they might be flat areas in which a person could do off-stream storage during flood time, as is done along the Clackamas River. Here's the alluvium that is thin, and here's the number of water wells per square mile. So we gave them this. Then they said, how much do you think you spent doing that? We gave them a number, and they said, good. They put it down as mats and used it to get a grant for themselves and moved on. What we've learned is that the best thing we can do with whatever resources we have is to map the underground plumbing. And as Gary's going to point out in some of his discussion, understand how rivers behave, the way they cut into their banks, migrate back and forth, and how to manage a river, because those are dynamic systems. And Gary will describe that to you. And so now that we've identified the core area that we might be of some unique assistance, we now know where to put priority. There are many basins of the state we have nothing to offer. To focus our efforts on there would not be productive because the geology does not dictate water behavior in a meaningful way, or because somebody else close by already has enough good answers, they don't need us in there. But there are other ones that are large, there are quality control questions, and there are things that we think we can do. So what I'm going to be doing is try to move the agency in that direction. As one of our two major priorities within Program 1 and 3, the other being a more coherent, consolidated statewide hazard effort, which Dennis talked about yesterday. I think I'll stop there and leave it at that. If there are any questions, I'd be really happy to talk about those. But then we should move on and make sure Gary gets his time. And then there was also the question about the earthquake.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative, thank you,
Madam Chair. Do you have the capability of really finding and at least reasonably mapping these very large underground aquifers that may be running deep underneath the surface.
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, as a geologist do, the more resource we have, the more background information, the better our staff, the better job we can do. Sometimes we have to say there's no water there. And we all, and in also in doing that, I hasten to point out that whatever effort we have done or will ever do with water has to be a joint effort with the water resource agencies and the water masters and whatever, because I cannot get into a water counting business. We're in the rock mapping business. And those two things together provide the answers. Either one of them alone isn't enough. We have to work together.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lynch would like to come forward now and take us through reclamation of surface mined land. We would all be very appreciative.
Mr. Lynch has been working in the background for 2 days.
He's unworked.
He's unworked. He's unhappy.
And I don't think you were here, Representative Krupp, when we were introduced to Mr. Lynch's mother, who is in the back room.
Well, hello, Mom.
Well, I don't know.
We always play Mom, don't we?
I have to say that that Mr. Lynch was very helpful in a particular circumstance we had last session and got to know him, and surprised he isn't wearing his baseball cap.
Good memory. It was wearing what little left up there. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Lynch, and I'm the supervisor of the Mine Land Reclamation Program for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, which is going to be one of the longer titles in state government. I know that Rich Engstrom is here to testify, and I know he has another commitment. So at your pleasure, if you could fit him in for 5 minutes ahead of time, it's your choice, obviously, but I do know he's also participating in the 404 hearings.
The chair would be very amenable to that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Engstrom. I'm the Managing Director for the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I thank you for the opportunity to do this. Larry Evans, as you know, the Healthy Stream Partnership is running the 404 Assumption and NIMS, and Larry Evans will be down testifying on that. And I want to go down and track that as part of my responsibilities for the chair of the statewide.
My understanding is they're collecting quite a crowd down there.
It's really where the action is today, Madam Chair. I am here to talk about the MLA program, just briefly to point out the industry's perspective of how the department is doing. And we have a very fine relationship with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. That doesn't necessarily mean we get everything we want, and I'm going to give you a couple examples on both sides of the coin. But what we do have is a lot of respect that is shared between industry and the agency. And from the industry's perspective, I can say that this is a very efficient and a very fine group of people to work with. I think that in budget committees and nowadays where many agencies are under the gun, so to speak, that it's good for an interest group to come in when there's success stories and express that to the committee so they know the fine work that a department has been doing. I want to give you some examples because, you know, it's easy to come in and just say stuff without examples. But this is the MLR program inspects about 1,900 sites, between 1,800 and 19 sites on an annual basis. They do that with a staff of 5 people, and that comes out to about a 300
biennial.
It comes out to about 380 inspections per person, or about 175 or so on an annual basis. That's moving along pretty quickly. They've picked up, and not only do they go out and they look at the sites and make sure we're complying with all the requirements of law, they've also picked up the stormwater program from DEQ, and they've assumed those responsibilities, which is another added burden to make sure that the stormwater runoff from one of the aggregate sites is contained and the pollutions are contained. So they're very busy. They're very efficient. They're essentially a fee-driven agency, and I know Gary will probably get into this a little bit. But the industry pays much of the budget for the MLR program. Matter of fact, it's about their $1.6 million budget that they use. Industry pays about 1.3 of that budget, approximately. It's, I think, 1.295. We have, in the past, several sessions ago, redid the way the fees for the agency are calculated, and we did them based on a graduated scale. And we've done that to make sure that they are adequately staffed to handle the load that has come into them. One of the changes that's happened in the 97 session is we felt it necessary to add a person onto the agency. And I know that the time will come up this year for the review of that particular person. And I just wanted to say for this committee that process has been going well. The graduated fee structure it has worked well. It seems to be very fair. The bigger guys are getting most of the attention. They pay a little bit more. The little guys are paying more minimal amount. Other examples OCAPA is one of the few organizations that was explicitly named in the comments from NIMS that came out in the 4D rules. And we sat down with the department and some other folks and basically drafted out what we saw as a limitation to the Endangered Species Act. The Department of Geology and Mineral Industries helped us work through some of those comments. We're not necessarily perfect as far as what we've put together yet as far as some rules for the industry, but in concept the agency wrote to NIMS and supporting the concepts that we have been moving forward. Our intent there is essentially to get a limitation from underneath the 4D rules, and essentially, which is just an exception process. They've been very helpful there. Down in the confluence in the Eugene area, Mr. Lynch has been involved with all the Eugene operators. This is a very unique program going down there where all the operators have gotten together with members of the community to try to resolve out how to deal with the reclamation and the mining in the confluence area while still providing necessary aggregates for the community down there. This is a very unique program. Mr. Lynch may talk about it a little bit here, but we're very excited about what's going on down there. It's a more collaborative, it's less regulatory, and so far things look like they're moving ahead fairly well. You know, we have the environmental side of it, and we've actually been trying to work through the environmental side at this point, and hopefully the end game here is we'll come up with a plan where we're going to be able to do what we can do in a very fish and environmentally friendly way for that community down there. And the department has taken a lead role in that and has been instrumental in kind of urging the industry and urging the environmental folks when needed, so that's been appreciated. One thing that just is a thankless job, and it makes my young years, puts gray hairs on me for my young years, is the land use process that we have to go through in getting aggregate sites permitted as an industry. Most of you remember 2419 last session. Most of you have been around aggregate battles all through your different communities where a company may be trying to get a site through. Well, the department is not really charged with getting involved in those things. The way the process is supposed to work is the counties make the land use decision, and the department then, once the land use decision is set, comes up with a reclamation plan. The operators to make the reclamation plan. Well, they kind of do extra duty in that so many questions come out in the land use process that they're actually assisting the counties and other folks in Fish and Wildlife and those folks in putting together the land use applications and working those things through. So it's kind of an extra thing that they've been doing to try to keep, you know, the lid on the simmering pot for siting aggregate sites. An example that I think it's fair to say that was a little bit rough this last time around is with the area bonds. One of the things that happened from our issues that we moved forward on last year is we wanted to get the bonding rate up for what it was really going to be as far as what the department would have to pay out if they were going to have to go in and reclaim a site if an operator defaulted. So there was in some cases, a fairly significant bump in the bonding rates. Well, there was some lack of communication that occurred there. but and that's a I think a fair criticism. Mr. Lynch and I've talked about it. We've got a plan in place that we think we can prevent those kinds of miscommunications from happening. What happened was is we got a bunch. And I shouldn't say a bunch. We had a couple of operators that had 100% increases or better in their bonds, and they just about fell off the chair. Instead of the department getting very defensive and saying, well, too bad. I mean, that's what it's going to cost us. And go home and cry to your mom or whatever. They said. they sat down with the operators and worked through the issues that the operator was looking at. Now, I would say that we haven't resolved all those issues. And they've really stuck to their guns. As a matter of fact, I sat with one operator that came in with just a lowball figure that didn't even pass the smile test as far as I was concerned. And instead, the department have an option of, with quite a bit of attention on this particular circumstance, of just saying, okay, we'll give you what you want. They held the operator's feet to the fire. They did it respectfully, and they did it factually. And in the end, the operator had to go back, do a little more homework. Hopefully he understands what he needs to do now, and will re-present the material to the department for a final determination on the matter. So, here's a thing that happened that could have turned into a mess. The department, by being respectful, listening, working with the industry, worked these things through, and from what I can tell, in an amicable way. There's some rulemaking going on, and the last thing I would like to say is, and this is more of a thanks to John Bolio, is there's been an aggregate position funded at the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and that position is supposed to be helping the counties in dealing with all of these aggregate issues that are out there in each of our counties in Oregon. And it's kind of a high turnover position. Most of the people that take that position burn out on a fairly quick basis, just because of the intensity of what they have to deal with. And ODOT, when the position was created, ODOT was actually contributing all the funds out of the highway fund for the position. And the rationale was is the aggregate is a statewide resource. Almost all of it's used for road construction of some type, so it made sense for it to come out of that. Well, ODOT decided that they were going to pull the funding for that position, and they were going to create their own aggregate position. We have an issue with that, and you'll hear about that in another Ways and Means discussion. The position is very important to the industry because it helps keep the counties complying with the law that we worked out in Goal 5. Instead of running amok and doing their own thing, the department has been very good about keeping the counties following the rules and the criteria that have been set out in Goal 5. Well, with the risk of losing the position, Dick Benner, John Bolio, Craig Greenlee from ODOT and the governor's office and myself sat down and essentially worked out how we were going to fund this position. DLCD is going to fund a major portion of it, about half. ODOT will fund a quarter of that position, and Dogami will be funding a quarter of it. And how that's going to work is the Department of Land Conservation and Development bids out projects for basically geology-type work to the private industry. Well, we have a bunch of geologists sitting in the department that can do that work for. And if I'm wrong on this, John, I am wrong.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the point. Let me. My understanding is I won't go far further because it's incorrect. But suffice to say, what happened was.
Richard.
So the point is there's going to be an exchange. The department's going to be doing some work for DLCD is essentially the easiest way for me to say it. We'll be able to protect that position. And it was the leadership of both Dick Benner and John Bolio that had to really come up with a compromise with ODOT's position of pulling that funding away from them. If we lost that position, I hate to say this, but the land use situation around aggregates almost at a tinder is almost at explosive level statewide. And that position is very instrumental in helping keep the fire down for the industry and making sure there's good land use planning that's going on. So we've been we're very pleased with the way the department has been working this last session. We have a good relationship with the MLR program, and once again, it's been respectful, even in disagreement. So thank you for your time.
I have a question. Would it be possible to put your org chart back up on the stand there? And Mr. Angstrom, could you show us on the org chart, does the members of your association, do they work mostly with the reclamation of surface mine land section of the organization, or does some of the your work extend into the other two areas?
It's almost all in the reclamation.
Okay.
Obviously, it tears up to John and discussions on policy questions. But we don't really get involved in the seismic issues and those other kinds of things. The sand and gravel, I mean, they pick up all the mining issues and all the geology issues, but we're pretty much confined to that part of their program.
And where on the org chart is the person that's working on, well, it wouldn't be because it would be in DLCD right now. Where would that person be? Would it be on this chart at all? It would still be in DLCD?
My guess is that it would be on DLCDs. But how that interplay works, you're going to have to ask Mr. Bolio, because I obviously need to.
Madam Chair, I believe that position they're discussing will be addressed in the DLCD budget as a policy option package. So you'll hear it when that agency comes forward.
Thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Nolan.
Since we've got the org chart up, I thought I heard two numbers for the Reclamation of Mined Lands budget, a $1.6 million budget for expenses and a $1.3 million that the industry contributes, and I take it that that is through a variety of fees.
Right. It's actually the total budget's 1.6. I'm taking it right off the chart that I think they
chart.
I picked it up back there.
I'm sure it's in one of these nice handouts, John.
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, this is something we passed out yesterday to you. It's the overview.
I have all of yesterday's stuff here. Just what I'm trying to do is get at. I see on the chart that all the boxes are yellow, which says there's no general fund money. Those are not general fund positions. And yet I'm hearing a gap,
right,
of between revenues and expenses. So where does the other $300,000 come from?
Hard work.
Yeah.
You're printing
I
money?
I was going to get into that. Whoa!
Legal hard work. I was going to get into that in my presentation. I'm sure Representative Miller. If you like it, I could address it.
I can wait if it's coming.
Do you have any other questions, or would you like to just let this unfold here?
I'll wait. I'm sorry to.
Please proceed. Thank you, Rich, for your presentation. It doesn't appear that we have any more questions for you, so you can go.
We should call the Secret Service.
Madam Chair, may I make one comment?
Of course.
There was also something that was handed out yesterday. Well, I picked it up today, and it's this cost-benefit analysis of activity of the Department of Geology and Mineral Resources.
Remember that.
If you go to page 4 on that thing, it talks about non-renewable resource conservation, and it talks about essentially the cost of moving aggregates around the state. And what they point out in here, and we've known this for some time in Multnomah County, is because Multnomah County doesn't have its own aggregate resources, and the haul distance to Multnomah County are coming from Columbia County, Marion County, Clackamas County, and some across the border, that the extra charge by them not simply having local aggregate resources could be as high as $15 million per year. I think that's an interesting note that we've known for quite a while, and it's one of the things we've been trying to say in the industry. The biggest expense for what we do is transportation, and maintaining our sources close to where they're being consumed very important for the state, who is the largest consumer of the resource, as far as a cost-saving measure. So with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And I think that is an issue that you don't look into this area for very long before that issue surfaces as a very big consideration. And being as it's the state that uses a lot of that resource, it definitely ups the cost of all of the public works projects that we look at. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, just real quick again, Gary Lynch, MLR.gammy. I can shorten it up quite a bit. I should start by something I told my staff the other day. I've always felt comfortable in this position talking about this program. And the reason is all that I really do is report what they do. And it's so I can sincerely sit here and just report what we do, and that's always seemed to work, and I think it's a credit to that staff. I'm going to be working off the Mine Land Reclamation Program brief, which really just puts the meat on the bones of the outline that John gave you yesterday. The front page is a brief on the Mine Land Reclamation Program. A second, which works as a brief, was a memo I wrote to Ken Rocco on the assumption we made of the DQ stormwater program. And then there are some relatively simple but I think effective graphs that may explain workload and some of those things. Today I'll talk about our performance measures, growth in the program over time, fees, and key areas that the program is working on and key challenges we face for the future. Simple numbers, 52 million cubic yards of aggregate are mined yearly or produced yearly in the state of Oregon or at least used. And that's a very accurate number because it's coming off scales. It's not, we know for a fact it's not perfectly accurate, but we know it's very close. The regulation of the industry is done by the Mine Land Reclamation Program. We cover all upland mining in the state. Upland mining is basically defined as that mining from the beds and banks of the streams, outside the beds and banks of the stream. We identify it as a two-year floodplain to the top of the Cascades, with the exception of Columbia County and with the exception of tribal lands. Tribal lands because they're of their sovereignty. Columbia County because they literally put a reclamation program in place prior to the state program and therefore were able to exempt themselves out from our reclamation program. The agency is staffed with 8 full-time employees and 1 half-time employee. We have anywhere, these numbers are somewhat fluid. We put out a monthly report, so sometimes you'll see me saying we have 816 active sites, and that was when I wrote this brief. We're up to 150 now, and that it is a fluid program, and that we open anywhere from 60 to 80 a year, and we close anywhere between 30 and 80 a year. So those numbers do change, but we're in the ballpark. It's saying between 825 and 850. We went over the budget, and maybe I can go directly to that question now from Representative Nolan, which is, yes, we are a fee-supported program. The industry pays the vast majority of those fees, but we've known for a long time that they don't pay all of the expenses we have. I've always said that I think it's healthy in government to have more work to do than you have money to do it. So what we have, where we make up the difference, is we aggressively pursue grants that have a benefit to not only the citizens of Oregon, but likely the industry as well. Some of those have been from EPA, where we put together a best management practices manual. That was actually a tri-state agreement. Unfortunately, the monies in EPA are drying up. There's not that much metal mining left in the Northwest. So we're seeing their cutbacks start to affect our grant opportunities. To offset that, we could see the ESA issues developing back in 98 in response to the Endangered Species Act issues. We worked with, I think, a very successful partnership with DEQ. I know it's endorsed by them, it's endorsed by us, where we now implement the stormwater program for 75% of the revenues they get for that program. They keep 25% The reason being, if there's a heavy enforcement action to do, we're going to bow out and say, okay, that's yours. That's been very effective. We also have started a fledgling abandoned mine land program. In fact, I was meeting in Portland today with representatives from D.C. and the Forest Service, where the Forest Service has given us a small amount of money to implement, to be the lead for the Oregon Abandoned Mine Land Program. So that's really where the gap is made up. We always have a few irons in the fire that way. Not all of them come through. Some of them do, and if they all didn't, we'd really have to scramble. But we have a very competent staff that answers problems in the field, and that's where we do our work. And I think that has allowed us to occasionally track the extra money that we need to make the program work. We feel that our motto is that we don't, and I say this so that, in a complimentary way, I don't think we can work a whole lot harder with the number of people we have, but we can always work smarter. And so that's what we're looking for, is ways to work smarter. And I think the stormwater program, and I'll get into a little bit of that, we can see how that works. The other thing I do want to mention that is important, because, and I think John has the handout on that, the 97 legislature did give us a fee increase, both a general fee increase that raised the general fees that all miners have to pay, or all operators have to pay, from $535 to $635. In addition, it created a graduated schedule for those operators who produce more than 100,000 tons. Their fees went up an additional $200 for every 100,000 tons they produced. Is that wrong number? Up to capped at 500,000 tons. So if you produce 500,000 tons, your annual fee is $1,835. Part of the bill required that we report to this session on how we thought that fee increase was working. And frankly, we over my 13 or 14 years here, we've had a number of fee increases. Surprisingly, and it's my inability to predict anything, I thought this was going to be a tough one to implement. It became the easiest one we ever implemented. And I'm not exactly sure why. I think, again, staff, I think, did a very good job of fielding the questions and explaining why. But so our recommendation is that we maintain the current fee schedule, and that's what's my understanding. That's what's required in the statute that was put in the 97 session.
Madam Chair,
Representative Nola.
On that point, you cap your fees at 500,000 tons of production. Do you know how many entities are capped?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, I don't know the exact number that are capped. I can tell you that it's not many. 500,000 yards of production is quite a bit. I can tell you that in 97 we had 100 of our approximate 800 permittees that were in that category. I ran the numbers the other day, and we're at 107. Now, of those,
107 are at the capped amount.
No, 107 fall into the graduated scale. Those that produce more than of the 107, I would estimate, and I can get you that exact number, but I would estimate it's in the neighborhood of 10 or 14, between 10 and 14 that produce more than 500,000 tons.
Madam Chair, if I might, just so I am getting these numbers in my head, you've got about 800 permittees.
Correct.
Roughly 700 of them are small enough that they hit the minimum.
Correct.
And you've got about 100 who are in this graduated.
Correct.
Schedule, and 12 to 15 who hit the max.
Correct.
Great. Thanks.
So with some of those details out of the way, maybe I'll start moving into the program. Another important point, as hard as we work at explaining this to people, and it's not necessarily well understood, the eligibility for a parcel of land to be mined in Oregon resides with the county. They issue the land use approval, and it's truly a siting decision, actually, that says this site can now be mined. And they assign a secondary beneficial use to that piece of property. Our job is to write the technical permit that ensures that the mining occurs in a way that there are not off-site impacts, and that when the site is exhausted, it's put back in a way that the secondary beneficial use is attained. It's confused sometimes by the fact that both land use authorities and our permit exempt certain sites. Any site mined, the footprint mined prior to 72, is exempt from the Mine Land Reclamation Act. In the last session, we did do a number of things to fix that, but it's much improved. And I can say that most of the battles we fight, not most, but a good portion of them, are where the land use situation is exempted into a non-conforming use situation, and where the mining is older than 1972. In a sense, the system works pretty well, but where you have those exemptions in place, landowners are allowed to move closer to the mine. The mine may have not operated in 15 years and suddenly does. And so it's a result of drawing lines. Those lines were well thought out, but they still are lines. But it is important to remember that any new mine, the land use authority decides whether or not that parcel can be mined, and then we join in. I'll briefly talk about our Oregon plan activities. As John pointed out yesterday, when agencies were allowed to apply for Oregon plan monies in 95, we weren't in that line, and we didn't get any of the Oregon plan monies from ballot measure 66. However, I think we've had a fairly active role in the Oregon plan, and I think it's active and effective both. We always look for ways to do two or three things based on the same thing. What we could see happening, and particularly as a result of the 96 floods, where the floodplain mining was going to be an issue for the state of Oregon, and it truly is. But it's an issue both with negative potential impacts and positive potential impacts. That is why we entered into the agreement with DEQ. Is there were a number of factors. One, the issue that's most difficult to deal with at aggregate sites. We don't have the severe contamination issues that metal mining sites deal with, and we don't have an active metal mine left in the state. But the limiting factor that to fish as a result of aggregate mining would typically be sediment loading as a result of runoff from the sites. That, in many ways, that was what the general stormwater permit from DEQ was supposed to regulate. We had our permit, which was kind of was overlapping that, and we said, you know, maybe we can get together here and save ourselves both work, since we're already going to all the sites. And frankly, DEQ had a horizontal authority, meaning they were dealing with 14 industries. We went to them and said, why don't we take on the role of implementing the stormwater permit? That also, the fundamental reason we did that is say that also gives us a role into the Oregon plan. We can now say, what is it that we can do to make that program better? One was to get everybody into permitting, and our permits, when we took the program over from DEQ, there were 120 sites that had general stormwater permits. Within a year, we had that up, and maybe that's 2 years, I'm not quite sure. We had that number up to 220. So right there is an effective decrease of sediment going into the streams, and that's one of our Oregon plan measures. In addition, we said, you know, the critical thing, Rich Angstrom mentioned it, we're a field-based program. The one thing we knew we could do better than DEQ is we could talk mining ease. And it's like any industry, I think. I think if you don't understand the mining industry, you can develop communication problems that feed the flames or cause enough confusion that you don't end up with the results you want to do. The one thing we understand is mining, and operators know that. Well, then we knew we could go to the field, and we do go to the field, and it's approximately 1,900 inspections per biennium. 500 of those are aerial inspections. The capacity to do that aerial photography program, which we've calculated about $20 per site, and I can't send anybody to the site for $20. We made sure we noticed every operator that if they did not want us to photograph their site, we wouldn't. And out of the approximate 850 sites, only two said they didn't want it, and they since changed their mind. allows us to produce an aerial photo. That photo I now see at Oregon State, you know, of each site in the state. I see those sites everywhere, and frankly, it upsets me at times because they'll take credit for taking the site, even though our name's at the bottom of it. But anyways, that happens. So we now have great ability to digitize information that we've never had before to know exactly how many acres are disturbed in the state of Oregon. We hand that photograph to each operator. There was no fee increase as a result of that, and we think it's a very successful program. And it also allows us to really get into the issues of floodplain mining, which I want to discuss briefly next, because it is the issue in terms of this, the aggregate industry, in terms of this program, that has the greatest downside and the greatest upside. The issues were, when we entered into this issue in a big way, the main issue was looking at the flooding problems to sites where rivers could be captured by deep pits. River Evulsive X, there's a lot of energy in that system during a flood, and they can tear into a pit, and the pit might not let that river go back to where it wants to go. And the whole issue of fluvial geomorphology is about the only thing I can really say that sounds geologic, because I'm not a geologist, but I get away with that one. Is a very difficult issue. We are doing it by on-the-job training right now. We did have a decision package in. It didn't make it, and understand why, but that need is still exists in Oregon for that kind of expertise. We've bootstrapped as much of that, I think, as we can, and we continue to improve it. But it's led us to a much more restrictive policy on the floodplain than Oregon has ever had. We now look at new sites and much of the industry's credit, I think, they've accepted the fact that some of these sites are now limited where in the past they weren't, in terms of how deep they can go. And if they can't go deep, they lose some of their resource. But if they do go too deep, too close to the river, they run the risk of capturing that river and degrading habitat. It's a very difficult balance, and it's a very complex issue. That leads me to that whole issue of floodplain mining. Two of the most successful programs I think we have, or models that we have going right now. One is at the Confluence Island, where we work with four aggregate operators, and they have formed a very fragile coalition, understandably so, because they compete on a daily basis with each other and for big bucks. And yet, and many of those sites were exempt, as I mentioned, but based on the 72 exemption. They have come together with the leadership of John Runyon and the Mackenzie Watershed Council, and I like to think we've played an important role there in saying, okay, let's look at 5 years and let's look at 50 years, and what are the opportunities to enhance habitat, maintain aggregate production in a growing area, and have the best of both worlds. It is a fragile alliance. We've got a long way to go, but they've come a very long way. Industry supported a fluvial geomorphic study of that area to the tune of about $150,000 out of their own pocket. OWEB we actually wrote a grant for the Mackenzie Watershed Council for them to participate. They received, and actually they just received their second grant on that.
That's what we're looking at.
That's what you're looking at there.
Down here.
You'll see, yeah, that's one of the mines along there, and there are others. It's a fairly extensive reach. What you see in the red are opportunities for increasing salmonid and steelhead habitat, but they'll need some modification, either connection with overflow channels. The easiest way to say it is what we're trying to do is broaden this floodplain, not to where it was in 1850, but broader than it is now. As you continue to broaden the floodplain, you by definition increase habitat.
And this is land that's owned by three separate companies?
Four separate companies. Yes. The other project that we have miles to go before we sleep on that one, but
you've been watching way too much television.
Yeah, that's actually, and I didn't read much poetry, but one I liked was Robert Frost stopping by woods in a snowy evening, and that's the only thing I can quote for you, I'm afraid, other than a few Irish songs.
Who's Bizarre, I think I know.
Oh, no. Actually, I'm not going to take it too far. The other The other project we have going on is very similar, but it has some interesting differences that we're saying, let's watch these differences. Let's not necessarily say one's better than the other. Here we're dealing with the Rogue River, where we have had an avulsive act that captured one of the pits, and that was during the 96 floods. There, it's simplified, and we have one operator, but we have multiple landowners, including Harry and David's Orchard and a number of agricultural concerns, a number of people who are concerned that this river, and we want it to be as wild as it can be, what does that mean to landowners, what does it mean to fish, what does it mean to aggregate supply? That one is also going along very well. So those two sites we look at as models. They are not changing the regulatory, and I might add that NMFS is involved in both of these, which is critical. Because we shouldn't say unbeknownst to us, we knew it was going to happen. We assumed a liability we never had before when the 4D rule passed, and that is our permit is a conditional permit. And so when we issue that permit, we now are subject to third-party lawsuits based on case law that came out of Florida and Massachusetts. So our answer to that is we understand that we have to be technically as competent as we can. We have to be as sophisticated as we can on these issues, but we also know we're required by law to make decisions. So we do that. A couple of just briefly, I want to mention that our awards program. Again, part of this is our Oregon Plan effort, but we started initially in 91 with saying, you know, one thing we think it's important to do is and we're not shy about it, maybe I should mention that we shut down by administrative order or more stricter tools approximately 80 to 90 sites a year for some period of time until they come into compliance. Now, in fairness, the vast majority of those are for late fees. It's a very neat tool, and, you know, we're not that stupid. If they don't pay their fees, we're going to... But we also have substantive issues for which they're shut down. So we definitely play the enforcement role, and it's a difficult role, and it's very time-consuming, but it's real. But if we're going to have that role, then let's also recognize who's doing the best job. Let's try to bring let's try to bring everybody along by rewarding them, by recognizing who's doing a really good job. That program is summarized on this placard here, Mine Land Reclamation Awards for 2000. This is our ninth straight year of doing this. The highlight of that awards program is the Oregon Plan Award, where the governor recognizes an outstanding mine operator or someone working in the mining industry related to it. We've had Grants Pass Watershed Coordinator was the winner of that 1 year. Last year it went to Parker Northwest Paving, who donated a former mine site, donated the land to Metro, which was the largest single donation Metro has ever received. This is classic habitat for salmonids. So we also recognize, not every year, the outstanding operator, the outstanding reclamation that has occurred in the last year. We give a award to a large operator, but recognize small operators have different challenges, so we have a small operator award. We do outstanding reclamation by a government agency. Obviously, they play under different rules, but their reclamation is just as important. Now, it doesn't mean that if there isn't a qualified candidate every year, the award doesn't get issued, but in general, we fill most of those. Those awards are done independently of the agency. We take the nominations shortlist and then hand them to what's called our award selection committee, which is made up of an environmental group person, an industry person, an agency person, a county person, and a consultant. And that, I think, has been a very successful program. And I'll conclude with that. And if I've missed anything, let me know.
Questions?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary, in light of a recent Supreme Court decision that had to do with Migratory Bird Act, Interstate Commerce Clause, in a a reclamation project, I guess you would call it, of a 50-year-old abandoned mining pit in the Midwest that several cities wanted to build into a landfill. Now, the Supreme Court ruling has put some sideboards on what can be done with those waters that are considered to be ponds and mud flats, and there's a whole list that they put in their ruling there. How does that affect what you do? Because you obviously have to worry about mitigation with ESA concerns and those types of things. So, you know, we're talking about the Clean Water Act, and we're talking about using the migratory bird rule as a method of denying that type of reclamation. How does that affect you? You think the Supreme Court ruling, how does it affect what you're going to do?
Andrew. Madam Chair, Representative Crepin, I got to check. Is this the Army Corps decision?
Yes.
Okay.
Of last the week before.
Actually, the second. And let me preface this by saying it's interesting. We're getting into competing issues under the ESA because
right. Terrestrial
habitat may look very different than salmon habitat when it comes to, the Western Pond Turtle, which
right.
is endangered. But particularly the issue that's really problematic for us in the recent Supreme Court decision, which is that we require, and we've had this example in this state, and that's why I'm sitting there a bit on pins and needles, because if this is going to, the price of poker goes way up. In this case, if we have a wetland created by the fact that mining has removed an amount of material, puts the material back in, that wetland forms, that's okay. That's an isolated upland wetland. Now, if waters from the state were to go in there, suddenly where the Corps didn't have authority, they may have authority.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we have is the Corps will say is if there's no emergent vegetation there, then that's okay, we don't have authority. But if there is emergent vegetation, which the Mine Land Reclamation Program is encouraging, because they may even plan to go back in there, but we encourage interim reclamation. We say rather than having that dry up and dusty, at least vegetate it. So we're part of the problem now. And we've put the operator in a very perplexing situation. The smartest thing to do if he wants to avoid core authority and extra regulation would be go out and scrape that every year, make sure nothing grew on it. We're sitting on the other side saying, let's let
the
it
opposite.
Grow. If nothing else, it's longbird habitat for a period of time. And that's a bit of an oversimplification of that site. It is the kind of issues we do run into on a regular basis. In the Endangered Species Act, I got to say, for the most part, we've developed a very good working relationship in the field with NIMS personnel. That they seem to be willing to consider being flexible on some of these issues, and by no means giving the shop away, but I really believe that we can come up with some models that will work for people. The only thing at times that scares me is at times federal regulation is far more or less flexible than state regulation, and that's a difficult problem, and we're all going to face it. Thank you.
Representative.
On your picture here, you said the floodplain has narrowed over the decades. Was that a natural occurrence, or is that caused by man?
That's definitely man-caused, and we see it particularly in the Willamette system, where the Corps had a mission back in the 30s and 40s to stabilize those banks, mainly for agriculture, but for other reasons. As they did that, the channel artificially narrowed because it's held within its bounds. It's no longer allowed to go. The rivers are wild. They want to go where they want to go. With that came some very positive social benefits. Agricultural production goes way up. But there were some negative benefits to wildlife in that habitat was taken out. Interestingly, a lot of those revetments and dikes are coming to the end of their useful life, and these rivers have continued to be somewhat wild and move bars, and it's an issue we face. But there, and this is exactly what we're looking at with these operators in Eugene, is what are the possibilities for opening up some of that revetment work when in restoring it as habitat. And that gets a really tricky issue because behind those aggregate mines in some cases are housing developments. So we have to be very careful in this process that as we increase habitat, are we increasing risk of flooding? That's that one geologic term I threw out at you, fluvial geomorphology. I like to say it, and it's very complicated, and frankly, Oregon has very little expertise in this area, and we know it, but we all struggle with finding the dollars to do it. But those are the challenges that face this program and face the state and face Oregon citizens in the future.
Again, well, you mentioned dikes and revetments, but you didn't mention upstream flood control dams.
They have an interesting influence on the system, and John Bolio and Dennis are probably better off at explaining this to me. But basically, what you can think of as those dams is they do some interesting things, and this is coming up as part of the committee. In fact, in our last meeting, we talked about this. What are the opportunities to do different releases of water? One of the things the Corps has done is they're very precise in when they release water. That's not necessarily even the best for agriculture or the best for fish. So can we look at those re-reg dams or those dams and say, are there ways to start to release more water out of there? And the Corps tells us that there is some real potential to do that. It's just people haven't asked. But they also take away the smaller floods. Correct me if I'm wrong, John, and they take off the peak of the really large one. You can come up with an event where you could blow them out too, but hopefully. Well, I live on a hill, so it's okay.
One more thought, please. You mentioned 1850 as a baseline for restoring the river. I saw that date in a watershed council meeting I once attended too, and I asked the question then, and I'll ask it now, why that date rather than 1492 or 32 A.D. or...
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, if that's the way it came out, it was wrong. I said we can't restore it back. The reason I said the date it did is there is some, researcher at OSU that went back to that date and tried to establish what the floodplain looked like. And it may have been 1847. I used the date 1850. And obviously it looks a lot different than it does now. And we're saying... it's not realistic to go back to 1850. It's not going to work. But can we look at strategic regional opportunities to broaden that floodplain in certain areas? Yes, we probably can. And we've actually got a couple of projects going on, one right in Corvallis at a mining company. Funded initially by EPA, we've worked with them. And we're seeing real benefits to salmon as a result of that. We never expect, if we went back to 1850, those subdivisions I'm talking about would be, you know, underwater on a gentle flood. So that balance is the job you guys are going to ultimately wrestle with and decide. When you
say that you're seeing real benefits to salmon in that particular project, what exactly are you talking about?
As I mentioned, and I didn't do a great job explaining all our Oregon plan efforts, but we knew for a long time that pits, when they flood, and some pits flood every year, it's just that's the nature of the Willamette, I can think of many, there is they always would have. The floodplain isn't very altered in there. Pits are relatively shallow, water gets down. We knew for a long time that occasionally fish would be captured in there. So we said, okay, But we do know that, but what else is happening to those fish while they're in those ponds? But one presumption was that they were being eaten by warm water species like bass. Well, we got together with ODF&W, and you can see some of these pictures. We actually went out and said, let's take a look at what's in the pond. And we said, okay, you know, one of the interesting results, and we worked with Peter Bailey from OSU on this, and Chip Andrus, who was with EPA at the time, and others. We started to get a pretty good understanding that, interestingly, some of the salmonids are doing very well in this situation. So, and I'm afraid I don't have a picture of this one. So Morse Brothers out of a builder supply site in Corvallis, we're working with Chip Andrus, built what we call an alcove. And all of that alcove is, if you think of the river going like this, the alcove is just a little offshoot or a barb that stuck up this way. And again, we didn't think that was going to do a whole lot. But interestingly, the real issue we're getting at, or the interesting, this suddenly small salmon started showing up this in far greater numbers than anyone would have expected. But it also provided habitat for the smaller fish that the small salmon eat. And I've forgotten the names of all those, but not that there aren't some problems with that. They will silt in over time. But the issue we're getting at, one of the key factors for salmon in the winter, because of some of this channelization that you see in systems like the Willamette, is that there's no off-channel habitat to get out of the fast-running water.
So the concept is refugia for the...
Correct.
Yeah.
That's what there's the real potential for the mining industry, if done well, and it's well understood, to provide some of that additional winter habitat for refuge. There's a few others, but...
Questions? Does that conclude your presentation?
That concludes my presentation, Madam Chair.
Okay. Does that conclude the agency's presentation?
Madam Chair, there was a request by Representative Krupp that we talked about hazards, highlights, and Dennis is prepared to take about 5 minutes to highlight the management charts around the room, but if you want to hear that, it might be good.
What we could alternately do is adjourn and reconvene tomorrow and begin with that. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify in the public testimony portion of the agenda?
Don't let my mother testify.
I was going to suggest,
Madam Chair, that we should recognize the excellent presentation that the son has provided. Applaud.
This was really a truly gratifying experience.
Was it better than the basketball game last night?
Yeah.
I did ask her the other night. She voted, their first national election was 1940. I'll use some discretion on that.
I remember who Roosevelt was running.
And without hearing any of the good stories about Gary Lynch's childhood, the committee stands adjourned.